This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Remember when you were a kid and you used to play Let's Pretend? What were your favorites? For me, I'll always remember Steve Hayes, the boy across the street, as our neighborhood's chief imagination organizer, including the time he took a large furniture box and pronounced it the ultimate tickle machine. One by one, we'd enter the box alone, then Steve would start to giggle, provoking all the other kids to laugh, and soon, whoever was in the box was laughing uproariously as well. Talk about an all-time feel-good experience. With that kind of imagination, there must be plenty of research predicting Steve would do well in life, right? Well, it turns out, findings about kids' play and imagination are not what most have long assumed. At least that's the discovery of Angeline Lillard, head of the Virginia Early Childhood Development Lab, who's back to get us thinking about the minds of children again, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. So, a whole bunch of personal questions here for you to start. How much do you remember about your childhood? How much do you remember about the kinds of games you used to play? Did many of those games involve elements of imagination or let's pretend? And if they did, have you long assumed that use of such imaginative role-playing had a positive effect on your development? Or, if you don't remember much about yourself as a kid, what have you observed about your own children? What kind of imaginative play have they engaged in? What effect do you think let's pretend type games have been having on their development? If you'd be willing to share any of your observations, we've got a phone line open for you right now at 888-WMRA-TALK. Back with us is the research psychologist who is forever questioning scientific assumptions. In fact, it is largely how she got into the work that she's been doing for almost 30 years now. More about that early start later, but we've asked Dr. Angeline Lillard back today to tell us about her latest findings on pretend play among children and what kind of effect such activity does or does not have on kids. Angeline, great to see you again.
Nice to be here, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And once again, for you who are listening, if at any point you decide you have a story to share or a question to ask, our phone number, in all numbers, is 888-967-2825. So, pretend play. How did you come up with the idea that maybe it was time to question all of the psychological, scientific assumptions about the impact of that kind of imaginative play on children?
I've been studying pretend play really since I went to graduate school, which is late 1980s. And I had long gone with the assumption that is very prevalent in the field that pretend play does something for development. Although some of my very first studies and my dissertation studies showed that it didn't do quite what people were thinking that it did. So at the time, people were thinking that children come to social cognition or understanding that other people have minds early in the realm of pretend play. And the reason for that is one of the really interesting things that children figure out when they're 4 to 5 years of age is that you and I interact with the world not the way the world actually is, but rather the way that we represent it to be. So, for example, if you show a child a Band-Aid box and you say, "What do you think's inside here?" Well, of course, they Band-Aids, just like you or I would. But if you open it up and show them that, in fact, you took out the Band-Aids and you put some crayons in there, and then you close it back up and you say, "Now, if your dad came home right now and he saw this box, what would he think was in there?" Five-year-olds can tell you, well, he would think that there's Band-Aids too, just like I did. But three-year-olds will look at you with a perfectly straight face and say he would think they were crayons. And you say, "And what did you first think was in here when you first saw it?" And they'll say crayons. So they don't seem to understand that we can represent the world differently than how it really is. But this was quite puzzling to people in the late 80s because children can pretend play. And pretend play seems to be exactly about representing the world differently than how it really is. And in order to pretend, they must understand that that's what we're doing. I mean, when I take the pencil and I fly it through the air as though it's an airplane, they must realize that I know that this is a pen, but I'm representing as an airplane. So then why don't they know that, you know, this box actually contains, you know, one thing, but I can represent it as containing something else.
So do three-year-olds then have a higher likelihood of actually getting into a state where they think that pencil is an airplane, and five-year-olds are more realistic about it?
You know, it's a very good question. It's something that's really puzzled people. Do children actually think that their pretend worlds are true? And no, it doesn't appear that they actually think that it's true most of the time. They seem to really hold a line between pretend and reality. Where you see some confusion is the same sorts of places that adults seem to show some confusion. So, for example, things that are really emotional. When we go to some really scary movie or say, you know, watching The Birds or something, you know, you really feel that fear. And so for a moment and in a way, it's kind of like you think it's real because you feel that fear. I mean, we use our emotions as a guide to what reality is. And likewise, you know, a young child, you know, there's one example in a paper of they really like to pretend that their father was a bear and have them their father chase them around. But then they have to say, no, stop, this is getting too scary. Another place where children have trouble with the real pretend boundary, we call it, is when adults are really trying to dupe them, like with Santa Claus, for example. You know, we work really hard to get children to believe that that's true. And so, of course, they do until they figure out logically that it's not true. But for the most part, yeah, they know that pen's not an airplane while they're doing that.
So for more than 40 years in your field of developmental psychology, there has been a pretty predominant belief that when children engage in pretend play, something very positive is happening for them. In all kinds of ways, it's improving their development mentally, emotionally, and we'll talk more about the specifics of that in a moment. But at some point, Angela, as with so much of your history and research, you started to say to yourself, how'd we come to that conclusion and what's it based on?
That's right. It just, you know, so I had that dissertation study come out, which actually my dissertation study showed that they didn't get mental representation in the realm of pretending. And yet there were still correlational findings. So associations between pretend play, especially social pretend play and theory of mind is passing this false belief test. So,
and there was this landmark book in the late 1960s that you think got all this started? It had something to do with children in Israel?
That's right. Helen Schwartzman came out with a book. It was published in 1968 called, it was about children who had come to Israel as immigrants. And she had noticed that these children were not as advanced in their language and in their social skills and their problem solving as the middle-class Israeli children who already lived there. And so she wrote a book about, theoretically, what might be the cause of these differences. And she targeted pretend play as being a possible cause because she noticed that these immigrant children didn't engage in pretend play like the middle-class children did. So most of the book is about, you know, theoretically, why it is that pretend play could be encouraging social skills and language skills and so on in the middle-income children. And how, if she could get these lower income children to engage in more pretend play, you might get more of these developments. And so she did actually come up with a study, and she divided children into different groups and had some of the groups engage in pretend play. They were trained to pretend play by experimenters. And she didn't actually go on to test the outcomes, except for a little bit of tests in language.
Basically, what she did was to prove that you could teach children to pretend play even when they didn't have any experience with that.
That's right.
But in terms of all these assumptions of what benefits kids get out of that sort of imaginative play, it didn't get...
She didn't go on and do the test.
And yet, it is sort of for decades afterward, there have been any number of studies that, I have a partial list here from your review that the assumptions were made that things like creativity, intelligence, problem solving, reasoning, social skills, language, emotional regulation, all improved in children the more that they engaged in this sort of imaginative pretend play.
That's right. So people read her book. And so this is, you know, Great Society era, and we're really trying to do something about, you know, low-income children and try to bring about more equality in society. And so, you know, Head Start is getting off the ground and so on. And so one of the things that people tried was pretend play training. So there were a number of studies that came out in the early 70s in which they trained groups of children in the United States to engage in pretend play or alternatives that were control groups, like, you know, listen to stories, engage in arts and crafts, do skills training. So that was one whole body of studies. And then other studies just looked at correlation. So when you go out on the playground, do the children who engage in more pretend play, and is that play alone or is that play with peers, do they then do better on particular tests? And of course, those latter type, the correlational studies, they can't tell you anything causal, but the training studies really can. Both types are ones that people cite as evidence that proves, quote unquote, that pretend play helps development.
And what you did over the past several months was go back and look at something more than 150 of these studies, look at them in detail about how the studies were conducted, what kinds of conclusions were reached. And do I understand, research psychologist Angeline Lillard, that largely what you found is they kept reaching conclusions based on what they wanted to see without seeing that something else could have been going on that was causing positive benefit?
That's right. So this all started in the spring of 2010. I'd gone to enough conferences at this point. There was a lot going on in Washington, D.C., and conferences like the National Association for the Education of Young Children, where there were these pretend symposia, and I was sometimes part of them. And people were very vehement about pretend play helping development. This Tools of the Mind program, which is a preschool program that really encourages pretend play. People were finding positive results from that. And so there was a lot of hubbub out in the field, and it was just getting so loud that I started feeling like I've got to read this literature more carefully and get a handle on this. So I started with an undergraduate seminar, a fourth-year seminar in the psychology department at UVA, where we read many of the papers. And from that seminar in the spring of 2010, I decided that there were really six major topics and then some subtopics under them that there was a fair amount of literature on that addressed the issue of whether pretend play helps these developments. And so then that fall, I did a graduate seminar, and those are my co-authors on the paper, the graduate students, Matt Lerner, Rebecca Dorr, Emily Hopkins, Carrie Palmquist, and Eric Smith. So we then read many of these studies in the seminar. They all wrote papers on different parts of or different developments. And then really from May of 2011 until last December, we worked on draft after draft after draft of the paper. We submitted it for publication, and then it's just been published a couple of weeks ago. So
that's the history of it. Isn't this a bit like kicking over a hornet's nest to challenge the assumption, not only among scholars and researchers in your field, but just the general public, that pretend play has wonderful benefits for kids?
It's a tough road to hoe here, because we all love pretend play. I mean, that's, you know, I have great fond memories of going out and, you know, pretending that there were Russian spies out in the woods and we had to go and find them, or taking, you know, the fallen tree and pretending that it was our Indian hut, and my sister pretending she was Desi Arnaz Jr. and I was his big sister. And, you know, we had a lot of fun pretending, and pretending's really captivating, and it may well do something positive for development. But I thought that it was necessary to really look hard at this and be intellectually honest about what it shows, because there's such loud claims that it helps development, and we have to be careful to not overstate the conclusions.
Well, we're happy to hear it from anybody in our audience that has questions for you about your findings on this subject. But you also, for many years now, have been working with this lab that you now head, the Early Childhood Development Lab, and looking at a lot of things that do or do not benefit young children. So I want to ask you about some of that when we continue here on Virginia Insight. Dr. Angelin Lillard is our guest. You might recognize her name from the study she did last year on the deleterious impact on children of especially fast-paced TV shows. Those findings have come to be known as the SpongeBob Report. Angelin's also well known for the research into the educational approaches used in Montessori schools that she's done. Her book on that topic is called Montessori, The Science Behind the Genius. But Dr. Lillard is with us today primarily to consider what science does and does not understand about the impact of pretend play on children. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Let's talk a little bit about the work that you do at the Early Childhood Development Laboratory at the University of Virginia. Do you look for what causes increased skills among kids, better social development, better social adjustment? Or I should ask a more open question. What does the lab do?
Well, these days, one of the things we've been doing a lot of is looking at how children manage to negotiate across the pretend real boundary. So what is it that they keep separate between pretend and real, and when does pretending bleed into the real world? So, for example,
what age children are we talking about?
Oh, we mostly study children from 3 to 5.
Okay.
Sometimes older children, sometimes younger. And so, for example, if a child learns something while they're pretending, like they learn the name of an object, how the object is used, do they then transfer that into the real world so that they could use it correctly there? So if the first time they saw somebody use a whisk to whip eggs, if they were pretending, you know, kitchen and say their mother or their babysitter was whisking an egg with something like a pen and they were calling the pen a whisk, would they then be able to, seeing that in the real world, say, oh, that's a whisk because I saw that and pretend? So that's one of the studies that we're working on right now. Another one, which was just published a couple of days ago, which we're really excited about, is actually on when pretending ends. So in all the textbooks, it says that children stop pretending when they're around 6 years of age, because that's what Piaget said. When they enter the concrete operational period, they're dealing with the real world. They no longer have to assimilate reality to their own wishes, which is
so what, this is Jean Piaget, who's sort of the what?
Grandfather of developmental psychology, okay. we call him. He really founded the field of cognitive development and the early 1900s. And so he said pretending really stops at 6, and all the textbooks then say that too. Actually, Vygotsky, another famous theorist who was more positive about pretending than Piaget, also said it stops at school age. But we didn't think that was true. Like my Russian spy memories, that's up to when I was 12 or so. And I watched my own children, especially my younger daughter, continuing to play pretend very actively with her friends up until 12. So, you know, we said, let's really look at this. So we gave undergraduates at UVA a survey of their pretend memories. And what we found, we've now done two studies, this is Eric Smith and I, the average age at which people report ceasing to pretend is actually 11 and a half years old. And a fair number of UVA undergraduates say that they still pretend. About 30% of them say they still pretend
on
a regular basis.
Well, if you're playing online games, if you're taking on an avatar, you're pretending, aren't you?
It's true. It's true. We're very fascinated by those kinds of phenomena. But this is people who say, like, when they're going to do errands, they pretend that they're James Bond, that kind of thing. So, or you know, girls who on a daily basis pretend that they are animals with each other. It said whenever they feel stressed, they just start pretending that they're animals in college.
So many things that I'm not saying right now. To you who are listening, what kind of let's pretend games did you play when you were a child? Did you engage in those games with others, or were you more likely to go off someplace alone and make up a whole pretend world for yourself? Have any thoughts on what those games meant to you as a kid? How having played them may have affected your own personal development? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825 in all numbers. Or on Facebook, you can find us listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Here on Facebook, we have this post from Elizabeth. Dr. Lillard, she says, I'm watching my two-year-old daughter really start pretending. Her sense of humor is developing nicely, too. She started dressing the dog as part of the pretend, and he seems to be okay with it. My favorite thing, though, is when she lines up the stuffed animals and reads to them. Right here in the things that Elizabeth mentions, is it possible that her granddaughter is engaging in things other than pretending that are beneficial to her development?
So in other words, while she's reading to the stuffed animals?
Or while she's dressing up the dog, or whatever is going on with her sense of humor while she's pretending.
Yeah, so I think, so for one thing, pretending just seems like it must do something good for development. I think that's why the field has been so sure that that is the case for so long. And yet the studies really don't show it when you look at them hard. But logically, it seems like there's a lot of creativity there. She's making up things for herself. One of the things that strikes me that we haven't really looked at is, does pretend play help develop children's sense of agency, their sense that they can do things out in the world? Because in our culture especially, we don't let children do all that many things. In the days of yore, children were much more involved in what was going on, say farming activities or babysitting younger children. And you go to the third world and you'll see, 5-year-olds babysitting 2-year-olds and helping to cook dinner and so on. They've got much more real stuff to do where they really can develop a sense of agency and a sense of sort of power to accomplish things. And in our culture, we don't allow children that much. So when they're engaged in pretend play is a time when they're really driving their own activities, when they're really in charge, when they're really able to do what's interesting to them and what they want to do, and they're able to make choices. And so it may be that there are benefits in those aspects of pretending that we haven't tested yet.
Research psychologist and early childhood development specialist Angeline Lillard is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Call-in number 888-WMRA-TALK. Eric in Harrisonburg, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for Dr. Lillard, please.
Greetings. Dr. Lillard, a couple of questions sort of on opposite ends of a spectrum, possibly. I'm not sure. First of all, you mentioned the age at which people stop pretending, possibly being around 11 and a half. It occurs to me, listening to that, that that's about the same age that I started getting into role-playing games. And so perhaps we could talk a little bit about role-playing games. Specifically, I was thinking of Dungeons and Dragons, but role-playing games in general are very popular nowadays. And on the other end of the spectrum, maybe you could talk about, with much younger kids, the phenomenon of imaginary friends and how earnestly young children believe that they're actually with another person or entity with imaginary friends.
Eric, those are both great questions. We're having a little bit of trouble with your cell, so if you'd be willing to listen to Dr. Lillard's responses on the radio, that'd be terrific. Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you.
So let me start with imaginary friends, which one of the foremost researchers in this is Marjorie Taylor from the University of Oregon, and she has interviewed hundreds of children about their imaginary companions. And one of the things that will happen when she has these 4-year-olds in and she's asking them all these questions about, their friend Tweety, who flies in the window at night and who, does all kinds of things. And they'll finally turn to her and they'll say, "It's not real, you know." I think that most children are very aware that their imaginary friends are not real, but they really enjoy cooking it up. So I had a couple of imaginary friends myself, and there was a time when people thought that children who had imaginary friends had real problems. They were worried about it. But in fact, children who have imaginary friends in Dr. Taylor's research, they're no different really than other children. Some studies show them to be slightly more intelligent. Some studies show that girls will tend to have an imaginary companion more, whereas boys will impersonate more, like pretend that they're Superman or things like that. But it's a charming activity that children seem to quite enjoy. One of the interesting things she finds too is that imaginary friends often meet violent deaths when she interviews people about them. So often they got run over by a car or something like that to end the relationship. Then you talked about...
Any speculation about why?
I didn't know.
It's time to get rid of the
I think it's the
friends.
Only way they could think to get rid of it. I don't know.
Yes,
I have no
Eric
idea.
Was also talking about role-playing games that he said started at about age 11 and a half for him.
Yes, and so that's an interesting question because we have only been, you know, looking recently. So it is people that would have had access to Dungeons and Dragons. Piaget thought pretend play stopped at six because children, as I said earlier, are more willing to accept reality then. And so they didn't need to create these alternative realities. And he said they get replaced with, pretend play gets replaced with games with rules. So he studied marbles, for example, a lot, which children were playing in Switzerland in the 30s. Quite a bit, you know, checkers, chess, sports games. When we interviewed undergraduates or had them fill out questionnaires about why they stopped, you know, there was a range of reasons. Getting interested in other things was a big one. Not having time for it anymore. Some got embarrassed by it. They thought it was childish, so they only did it on the sly by themselves or with a couple of good friends.
Do psychologists know anything about those of us who engage in role-playing games as we get past or into and beyond our teens and those of us who don't?
Yeah, it's a fairly new literature. There's some really interesting findings in it where, for example, if people pretend to be an avatar who is, you know, sort of taller, darker, more handsome than then if you're a man, then they'll be more likely afterwards to ask a woman on a date than if they pretended with an avatar that was, you know, short and dumpy. So interesting things where we do seem to kind of take on the personalities of avatars, but there's much more to be done on that. But that suggests a kind of lack of real pretend boundary in adults when they play these games, and that's one of the things we're really interested in with children. So if a child pretended with a doll that the doll was really nice or that the doll was mean, are they then more likely to be nice or mean themselves afterwards?
And the answer at this point is we don't know.
Our initial studies suggested that they had a pretty good boundary about this. You didn't see a whole lot of transfer from what it was they were pretending. We've been doing a study where we've been looking at classic old studies by Al Bandura with the Bobo dolls that showed that when children saw an adult sort of punching and kicking around one of those big rubber punch dolls on a film, that they then would go and imitate the behaviors. What we've been seeing lately is we don't get that much imitation of it when children have watched it on a video. We get much more when they read about it in a book.
Hmm. If you now or ever in the past have had young children in your household, I'm curious what struck you about the kind of games that you saw they liked to play. Did one child seem to have more imagination or more interest in let's pretend than another? Come to any conclusions or questions about that that you'd be willing to share with us? We've got a phone line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Research psychologist and early childhood development specialist Angeline Lillard is our guest. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on our Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. On Facebook, we got this from Jennifer. Angeline, Jennifer says, are certain types of let's pretend games better for mental development than others? Is there any difference in playing tea time with dolls, for example, versus maybe a role-playing game where kids themselves take on different pretend identities?
That's a very interesting question. So, in some of the studies that have been done, they find that children who engage in more pretend play with peers, so social pretend play where, you know, you pretend you're the mommy, I'll pretend I'm the daddy, this is our baby, or we're going to pretend that we are, I don't want to say Ninja Turtles because they get a little violent, but something like that, where you're going to be pretending to act out a scenario with other children. Studies have found that when children engage in those kinds of activities, they are more apt also to have better social skills and more social understanding, going back to the false belief task I talked about at the beginning, than children who engage in more solitary play. The problem with those studies is, first of all, they're correlational. So you don't know that the pretending caused the social development. It's possible that the children who are able to negotiate with peers and figure out who's going to do what roles and figure out the script and so on are already more socially competent, and that's why they're able to engage in more social pretend play. In fact, there are suggestions in the literature that it is that direction of causality. And so that's one problem with those studies. Another problem is several of them took place on a school playground. So if a child is on a school playground with, you know, 20 other children, and they're, say, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of age, children who play alone in that situation versus children who play socially might already be different in certain ways, such that the social play is not causing the increased creativity or increased intelligence that you saw in some studies. It may be that the children who are playing alone already have those characteristics of lower creativity and lower intelligence, and that makes them less able to figure out how to get the other children to join them and engage in the pretend play. Maybe they're just less mature, is another possibility that would then have these other outcomes. So it's not clear whether these different types of pretending are different. I will say, though, another finding out in the literature is that quote-unquote hard-to-manage children, this is a British term, this was a British study, hard-to-manage children, the more that they engaged in pretend play, the more antisocial behaviors they showed. But their pretend play was particularly violent pretend play. And so they reasoned in the study that it was because these children were acting out these really violent themes that they were then working up these difficult to manage capabilities in themselves and getting used to playing it. So the answer is, yeah, possibly. You know, it seems like, you know, probably, you know, playing some things might be better than others, especially playing things that are violent might be associated with more violence. But it may be that children who are already feeling violent to begin with end up playing more violently.
Is there something going on here for you, research psychologist Angelin Lillard, about scientific honesty, or at least getting away from assumptions that we don't have a scientific basis for?
Yes. Yeah, so that's really what drove us in doing this. So wanting to find an answer to this question, does pretend play help development? And part of that was hearing it so vehemently claimed again and again and again. And even down to where, you know, parents make school choices based on how much pretend play there is in the day. So, you know, being somebody who is quite familiar with Montessori programs, I would hear people say, well, I couldn't send my child to a Montessori school because they don't have pretend play there, and I know that pretend play helps development. Well, if it's not the case that we know that pretend play helps development, then that's not a reason to choose or not choose a particular school.
I want to ask
school.
You more about Montessori, since you've done so much study of that educational approach, and also some of the other things that you think parents might benefit about hearing about developmental psychology for kids. We are looking at pretend play and the impact it does or does not have on the children who engage in it. Our guest heads up the Early Childhood Development Laboratory at the University of Virginia, psychologist Angelin Lillard. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Phone number 888-WMRA Talk from Bridgewater. Bill, thanks for calling in.
Hi. The person interviewing there asked if pretend play might affect your life later or benefit you. I'm 70, and when I was a kid, I was Roy Rogers all day, every day. That's all we did. We run and play and shoot and dive behind trees and roll. And I was Roy Rogers. I became Roy Rogers. Well, in 1966, I was drafted in the Army and sent to Vietnam, and with woefully inadequate training. There's no training. And sometimes people ask me how I survived, and it's because I became Roy Rogers again. And I dove, and I rolled, and I hid, and I crawled, and I became the ground. And I did all the things I did as a little child, and I survived. And I really believe it's because I was Roy Rogers again.
Yeah, so that imagination really helped you to face extremely difficult.
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite understand you.
So your imagination really helped you to carry out these difficult tasks that you were faced with.
Oh, absolutely. The first time we were in a serious situation, a firefight, actually, I just did what I did as a kid. I hid, I dove, I shot and rolled. I did all the things I did as a kid because I certainly had no training in the States, in the desert, in Fort Carson, Colorado. I had no training for the jungles of Vietnam, but Roy Rogers saved me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Bill, thank you so much for sharing that observation.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Angela, and what Bill is saying, it reminds me of something that I have heard a number of times from people who, how do I put this, grew up in very difficult circumstances where there was alcoholism or drug abuse or violence in their homes, that they felt escaping into the world of characters they saw on television, whether it was Wonder Woman or Roy Rogers or Gunsmoke, the Lone Ranger, Superman, that playing those roles, playing those characters, took them out of really the agony and the fear that was otherwise pretty much all of their daily lives, at least when they were at home. Do you give credence to the idea that that kind of pretend play may, in fact, have been crucially important?
I think if it's somebody's personal experience that was helpful to them, then that was helpful to them. You can't argue with personal experience that way. When it comes to research studies that look at whether, say, for example, pretend play therapy helps children to get better, when you talk to therapists who do this with children, who set up the sand play and so on, most of them are convinced that what they're doing is helping children. But when you look at meta-analyses of the research studies that were done on it, their conclusion is that there's no evidence that it helps. So, you know, it's the difference between personal experience and, you know, there can be ends of one, small ends. There might be a set of people who it helps, but it doesn't show in a study the way that we've done the studies. But pretend play certainly can provide an escape from difficult circumstances, and you can't argue with that.
Well, to you on the other side of your radio, if you are a parent, is the subject of pretend play something you've given thought to in the past? And how does what you've been hearing here relate to your ideas on childhood development? We've got the phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Or you can reach us on our Facebook page where we are listed as Virginia Insight.
Another thought from Bill, who just was talking, was that he also seemed to be talking about how he learned certain motor patterns by engaging in pretending that he was Roy Rogers, that he was then able to use when he was serving in the military. And certainly there's nice research showing, you know, even, say, a professional golfer imagining taking the shots, that actually does help them, that you are actually using a lot of the same neural machinery when you imagine doing something as when you actually do it. So playing it through in your mind, even if you're not actually carrying out the actions, can help you to work up those motor patterns so they become automatic for you more.
Well, let's talk about Dr. Maria Montessori.
Mm-hmm.
Was it the late 1800s, early 1900s, that she was developing what would become Montessori education?
That's right. She opened the first school in 1907.
And you've written that she didn't hold much stock with pretend play.
That's right. So she had toys in the first Montessori classroom that she opened. There was a little dollhouse that, you know, had lights on, and other toys that were donated by the Society Ladies of Rome. What Montessori found was that the children weren't that interested in them compared to the other things that they had available to them to do. So, for example, compared to really arranging real flowers or, you know, cooking some biscuits and washing the dishes or sweeping the floor or counting out glass beads, they were more interested in doing those other things that she called work than in playing with the toys that were there. So eventually she took the toys out of the classroom because she kept the room very simple. She only kept in there what children were using and seemed to be learning from.
And so her point of view was that whatever age the child was, what they were capable of accomplishing that felt to them like a real accomplishment was what they were most interested in doing?
Yes. I mean, one of the famous little stories that she has in a couple of her books is when children were first learning to write and then to read, she would give them a card that had a word written on it, and if they could read it, she would let them play with toys. Well, what she found was they just threw the toy on the ground and said, "Can I have another card? Can I have another card?" What they really wanted to do was read, not play with the toys. So she deduced from that play is something that children do when there's not something that they find more interesting. And she thought that they were really driven to do things that helped their development, that there's an internal drive to that.
Stanley in Stanton, thanks so much for calling in. Your question or comment for research psychologist Dr. Angeline Lillard, please.
Yes. One of the things that I've been kind of paying attention to over the last few years is people feeling out of control. One of the articles I read in Science News was talking about a teenager playing video games, not, you know, shoot 'em up games, not because he liked killing people, but because he liked feeling in control. And it strikes me that having an imaginary friend is a way of controlling something. And if you have other means of in your life of controlling, perhaps the 5-year-old or 6-year-old might not need an imaginary friend.
That's an interesting thought, and I haven't seen studies sort of looking at need for control in children's pretending, but it is true that in our culture, we don't give children a lot of say in a lot of things. You know, adults are often dictating, you know, when you need to do this, when you need to do that. And pretend play is a situation where they are in control. They can decide who's going to be what, who's going to do what the program is, and So perhaps that is one of the benefits there.
When I was a child, I grew up on a farm, and basically my mother had enough other things to do, and I just ran around the farm and, you know, the pasture, and I don't remember ever having imaginary friends, but I could kind of do whatever I wanted to.
Do you remember what kinds of games you played either by yourself or with others when you were on that farm, Stanley?
It was pretty much just enjoying the cows and you know, putting sticks into the stream that went through the pasture and chasing them down and that sort of thing.
So, you know, it may just be a real individual differences thing. I was quite free and was on a farm, but I had a couple of imaginary friends. I had 3 older sisters, and they didn't want to play with me, so I just made up my own friends. Because I wanted somebody to play with.
Well, I had an older sister and then 2 that were out of the house. But my sister remembers taking me out in the woods and tying me to the trees.
Oh. Ouch.
She keeps bringing it up and thinks I'm still blaming her for it.
Well, we are very glad you survived and very glad you called in. Thanks so much, Stanley.
Well, it's an interesting show. Thank you.
Is it possible that in our culture, when it comes to how we interact with children, what we provide for children, that we have forgotten as adults pretty much what it's like to be a child? And is that any different, Angeline Lillard, than other cultures where attitudes towards children are different?
Very interesting question. Have we forgotten what it's like to be a child? Sometimes I think that, for example, in presenting children really fast-paced television or just the fast pace of life that we present to them, all the activities we want to take them to try to be sure that they have the skills to succeed in this complex world that we're in, I think that we do overwhelm children as a culture. I think we forget how hard it is to take in the world when you don't know anything yet, and that they do have these minds that are just absorbing impressions all the time and trying to make sense of it. And I think we forget what it's like. Of course we do, to just not know very much yet, and to be trying to take it all in. Most other cultures are much slower with children and don't bombard them with nearly as much. They're even slower with adults and don't bombard them nearly as much. I remember having Norwegian au pairs, back when my children were young, say 15, 20 years ago, and they just couldn't believe our stores, that we had so many options of what kind of soap to buy. They found it completely overwhelming. So, we are a culture that really loads up a lot very, very fast, and I think that is hard for young children's minds.
Angela Lillard, is as much as you are criticizing the assumptions that your field has reached about the supposed benefits of pretend play, one of the things that I know you've been saying is we need more research. We need better research. We're not saying that pretend play is bad or not valuable, but let's know for sure. In addition to that,
mm-hmm.
I want to make sure that people listening aren't hearing an implication that you think play is a bad thing, because you have some fairly strong views about schools that have been getting rid of recess, for example.
Yeah, no, I think pretend play is an absolutely wonderful thing, and it's a fun thing. And I would never tell parents to say, don't let your children pretend. But I would also say that if you have a child that's not as interested in pretending as another child, I wouldn't worry about it. It doesn't seem like it's a problem. And I would, in choosing a school, I would look at, what looks good about the school. Don't worry about whether it has pretending or not. If your child wants to pretend, they'll pretend at home for sure. But when it comes to play more generally, so pretend play is a very specific type of play that involves imaginary projection of some alternate reality onto current reality. And then there's just play, running around, chasing each other, climbing on the jungle gym, swinging on the swing, all the fun things that children and even adults do. There's plenty of very solid research showing that kind of stuff is very good, and that, for example, in a conventional school program where children have to sit a lot of the day and listen to a teacher in order to learn, so the teacher's, writing on the board and the child sitting in a chair, as opposed to, say, a Montessori program, perhaps some Waldorf programs where they're able to get up and move around more. When learning involves just sitting still a lot of the day, we do know that recess is very helpful to restore children's attention. So if they take the same types of classrooms of children and one of them gets a 15-minute recess in between every 45 minutes of listening to the teacher lecture and the other one doesn't, the children who got the recess will pay better attention after recess than the children who weren't able to have recess during that time.
So getting kids out of their chairs and moving and engaging in some kind of play, if it involves physical activity, you see is always a good thing.
Yes, especially if they are in a school situation that involves just sitting still. Another thing is how helpful exercise is. So, there are studies showing that when they started in some schools having gym first period, so go out and get some physical exercise right away in the morning, those children then do better in school than children who don't have gym until the end of the day. Getting your body going, getting your blood going, getting your heart going, may be feeding neurogenesis, is what some research suggests. But certainly exercise is a very good thing for the mind and getting learning going.
Angela, you've been studying the minds of children for more than 30 years now. In less than a minute that we've got left, is there any one thing that you've discovered, both as a scientist and perhaps as a parent, that you think it might be good to remind other parents of?
I think one thing that is extremely important is remembering to watch your children closely and listen to them, because being sensitively aware of what signals they're giving off is the best scientific evidence that there is out there. Any child might be different from the results of any particular study, but there's no substitute for a close, careful, observing parent.
And if you have your way, there soon will be more study on pretend play.
I hope so.
Our guest has been the director of the Early Childhood Development Laboratory, as well as a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, Dr. Angeline Lillard. Angeline, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org and then clicking on programs and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Dr. Lillard is doing. And if you go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page and click like, you'll get access to a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.